Osiris.
We are live. We are live here on the internet. I'm RJ. This is Brian. This is called The Live Show. Brian, it's a steamy week here. How are you doing?
RJ, I'm doing well. It's Thursday. It is, I think I'm the first person on the internet to say this. It's the fifth anniversary of the start of Fish's Baker's Dozen, which we're not here to talk about, but maybe in the future we will. But we did talk about on a previous season of a little podcast called Undermine, which was a massive, massive live accomplishment, not just for the New York metro area, but for the world.
For the world.
And what we are going to talk about today is an artist who is not just an artist for the New York metro area, but an artist for the world.
For the world.
Do you like how I did that?
He is for the people. That was great. We're talking about 12/12/75. I got a lot of thoughts. I'm sure you do too, Brian. So I guess before we get into it, we should tell everyone a little bit about some of the events we have coming up. I guess yesterday we did it in order of announcement, but maybe today we can do it in chronological order. So I'll just tell you guys quickly, if you're going to Atlantic City for the Fish shows, come and hang out with us at the Anchor Rock Club. We have 2 days of stuff, 2 to 4 p.m. Saturday and Sunday. Saturday we'll be having John Barber. We're going to do an interview with him. He's going to play an acoustic set, which will be really great. Sunday we're going to do a really cool auction with the Waterwheel Foundation. Waterwheel sending us a bunch of kind of rare fish stuff and stuff that you can't get anywhere else, and it'll raise money for the foundation. So those will be really fun. Those are free events. There's an RSVP link at osirispod.com/osirislive. And Brian, but that's not all.
That's not all. There's more. There's always more. And it's a good more. We will be in Milwaukee on Thursday, August 11th at the Cooperage, which is this really, really cool venue. You can take kayaks out into the river. You can go there and have some excellent local beers. It's in a really awesome space where there's a ton going on in Milwaukee, and it's this great, great venue that we're going to be hanging out, talking to, and listening to the music of Mr. Riley Walker. And it's Riley's birthday today. Happy birthday, Riley.
Happy birthday. Happy birthday. We missed him for the Dave Matthews series, but we'll get him on here eventually.
We'll have to bring him back for a Lily White special type of series, a type of episode, like another one of those summer 2000 episodes that those shows were so great. But we'll probably talk a bit about that with Riley on August 11th. We will be there in the evening. Doors open at 6:30. Show starts at 7. It's going to feature some conversation. RJ and I will both interview Riley, and then he'll play a set. And you can get your tickets at osirispod.com/osirislive. And then just 20 days later, my goodness, we will be reaching the end of Fish's summer tour, and we will be kicking that off with an incredible night of music here in Denver, Colorado at the Larimer Lounge, Wednesday, August 31st. Music and conversation featuring Taper's Choice, one of the great new bands of the post-pandemic era. They emerged from LA. It's a collection of just awesome artists from a ton of different bands who came together collectively to jam and to write some really cool songs and to jam. And did I mention that they jam? Their jams are very, very good. I will be interviewing them along with HF Pod co-host Jonathan Hart, who's interviewed multiple of the musicians, Alex Bleeker, Dave Harrington, Chris Thompson on the Broke Down podcast. It should be fantastic. That will be the evening of August 31st here in Denver, Colorado. If you get into Denver before the Dick shows, come on over. It'll be a good hang. OsirisPod.com/OsirisLive. We'll be talking a lot more about those in the coming weeks.
There we have it. So we hope to see you guys out there. We had an amazing, amazing event this week at the Ardmore Music Hall, and we're just going to keep doing these events. So hope you all keep showing up. Brian, we are talking about 12/12/75, and I think this is, and I guess I should say before we get into it, if you're listening to the podcast version, You know, please review, share. Thank you for helping us out here. What's Greendale, New York, and why are we talking about this show?
So we're in a really interesting era for Bruce Springsteen, and Greendale, New York is one of those kind of offshoot towns outside of the New York metro area that Bruce really came up and spent the early 1970s into the mid 1970s, just making a name for himself, playing clubs, playing bars. Greendale, New York is most famous for being the home of CBW Post University, which is where this concert is held. It is a campus on Long Island. It's named after the inventor of breakfast cereal, a man named Charles William Post, which is, you know, you and I both slightly ambitious people, really care about creating things, really care about new ideas, want that when we go, whenever, you know, whatever you get, 60, 80, 90, 110 years, who knows how long that we'll live with medical advancements. But when we go, when we're in the ground, I don't just want my kids to remember who I am. I don't just want their kids to remember who I am. I want like the world to know my name. You know what I mean? Like there's that thing that drives you. Can you imagine being remembered for something as incredible as breakfast cereal? Like how many bowls of cereal do you think you've eaten in your life? Just take a guess.
Maybe like 10,000.
Yeah, it's somewhere in that range. You know? Like yeah. So many that I didn't even think about that my mom was just like, I don't have the energy to make you food. Just eat this. And just like threw it in front of my, like one of my son's chores right now is to pour cereal for him and his daughter, or him and his sister, because, you know, I just need him to do stuff. And this guy, Charles William Post, invented breakfast cereal. He also, not to go down this rabbit hole too much further, he's the father of Marjorie Merriweather Post. That name sounds strangely familiar, doesn't it?
Yep. Yep.
It's the name of a really good Animal Collective album, Merriweather Post Pavilion. It's also the name of a venue that Fish will be playing next weekend and have played some incredible shows at. So that's where this is taking place. This is taking place in December of 1975, like right as we're about to move from the early 70s that have been dominated by Watergate and inflation and gas prices and really good records, but a year with very limited Grateful Dead, into the latter part of the decade that is going to be dominated by inflation and high gas prices and presidents that everybody forgets about, the Grateful Dead returning, disco, and as we move towards the 1980s. This is kind of like, if there's any point in Bruce's career that is like the epicenter of like the shift between classic rock being the zeitgeist and starting to become nostalgia, it's like happening right here and now. And you can kind of feel the ground shift during the show, which is something I want to talk about as we get into this. But last point, just in terms of the band, like they released Born to Run on August 25th, 1975. And this is really a point in their career where they're introducing themselves to larger markets. They go to Los Angeles for the first time. They're going overseas. There's that really famous Hammersmith Odeon show from fall of 1975 in London that was released. Like this is the point where Bruce is still playing small towns like Greendale, New York, while also starting to take a step up, and Born to Run is making a huge cultural impact.
Yeah. 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 Thanks for that background. So, I mean, this, let me just get into my first kind of theme or question.
Yeah.
Just cause we're going to just, let's just get into it. Is this a perfect Bruce Springsteen show? Cause I kind of think it is. I kind of think it has everything. And compared to the show we talked about yesterday, there's a lot, but I'll leave it at that. And then maybe we can keep talking about it.
So I'm going to say my short answer is yes. And then I have a longer answer as well, because I think the interesting thing about Bruce, and as we're like exploring these 10 years apart eras where he plays Giant Stadium, but here he's like clearly trying to win every single person over in this bar, even if you've already been won over by him, is no matter what era he's in, he is singing for the person in the back of the room. And he is trying to bring that person into the show. And that is something that is immediately ever present. But the thing that's fascinating we did this in our Dave Matthews series, and I think it's fair to do it here as well. This reminds me of like the Grateful Dead in 1972 or Fish in 1993, 1994, where you have a band that is at a point in their career where they have yet to write like a quote bad song. Every song that they've written is going to be remembered as classics. And in 20 years, if they play any of these songs from this show, it's going to be regarded as like either a staple part of a concert or like an incredibly special part of a concert because it's something that they don't hear as much anymore. And you get all of that compacted into one concert where there's literally no breaks. And every song that starts, you're like, oh no, this is the best Bruce Springsteen song of all time. So it's this very strange mix of like, he has so much left to do. Like Darkness on the Edge of Town hasn't been written. The River, nothing off of Born in the USA has been written. He hasn't gotten into like the middle part of his career. He's still trying to make it. And that energy is like through all of these songs, which are all classics, but also through the performance.
Yeah. I mean, I love the, so maybe I'm just like more of a 70s music fan than an 80s music fan. I guess it's probably that simple, you know, like these, it's a little more stripped down, you know, and there's less the storytelling, which we talked about a lot yesterday. There's not that much of that here. There's a little bit, you know, but it's not quite the revival that you get in the 80s. You know, but it's pretty fantastic.
It's interesting you talk about the storytelling because I was thinking about it when I was re-listening to parts of the show this morning. There's the moment late in the set where he's playing Jungle Land, which is just a song that was clearly written with, it's ambitious with all caps. Like that song, there's an alternate universe where Jungle Land is just like a totally mocked, overwrought rock opera type of piece because there's everything in there. The story is so dramatic, but then he finishes it and it's this big epic moment. And rather than tell you a story to get into Rosalita, he just strums the first chords and goes, and then as if he knows, I don't have to tell you anything. You all are hearing the chord here, and I'm just like bridging us from Jungle Land to Rosalita. I know that this is so worthwhile. So the music's speaking for itself more than his words.
Yeah, that's fair. Yeah. I mean, and you know, we could talk about the kind of the jams, because there are some jams here. You know, unlike the 85 show we talked about, there wasn't a lot of jamming. But we'll get into that. What kind of thoughts came to you as you were listening through this 75 show?
So one thing that came to me that is really, I think this is going to be like an interesting topic to dive into throughout this series of diving into Bruce. You mentioned you think you're more of a fan of the 70s rock than you are of the 80s. I think of Springsteen as a connecting piece between the past and future of rock music. And it kind of goes hand in hand with what I was saying about like where we're at when this concert happens. Like, I don't know if you can pinpoint a moment, and maybe somebody has tried to, and I just have missed this, but I wonder if you can pinpoint a moment where rock music goes from being like current music to being music of the previous generation and thus a nostalgic piece, you know, and we're at a point in history where like all the boomers that came up listening to this are starting to get towards the end of their life. And there's a huge question of, is rock music going to live on in the way that we all expect it to, because it's so front and center in our upbringing and in the music we listen to, or is in 20 years, rock music going to be looked at as like the way that jazz is right now, or the way that like big brass bands are looked at right now from the early 20th century. And Springsteen to me always strikes me as someone who was born slightly too late. And as a result of being born slightly too late, is constantly trying to bring these elements of the 1950s and the early 1960s forward, while also having the technology at his disposal to make something like Born to Run that 10 years prior was not possible to be made. Like the sonics on that record and on that song were not possible. And so it's part of why I thought yesterday, like I was talking about how he is in a lot of cases the best fit classic rocker for the 1980s. Like the sounds in the 1980s fill hit, or they work with his songwriting better than they did with Neil Young, better than they did with Bob Dylan, a lot of other artists. But I was thinking last night about, like, he's playing songs that inherently sound like a throwback to rockabilly, that inherently sound like a throwback to the folk revival of the early 1960s, but are filtered in this way that just, like, blows them out. What do you think about that?
That's really interesting. I think that's totally fair. I mean, you get like the Beatles, you know, who brought kind of like some of that early 50s music into the 60s, right? And I guess a lot of, you know, Zeppelin did that, the Stones did that, particularly with blues and early blues. And this seems like a decade or more later, you know, kind of similar thing. That's interesting. And he's still got a lot of like not past, but he's got some classic kind of music, you know, like all these, just these songs that he plays over and over. I mean, there's something very timeless about it, which I think is pretty cool. I was looking at I haven't talked about this yet, but there's a website called Bruce Bass, which is where like the set lists are, but there's also a cool feature called news/memorabilia. And in every show there, if there is something, you know, if there's something written, et cetera. And the headline from the show says Springsteen captivates 3,000 in semester's last concert. It's like a end of the semester, 3,000 people. Can you imagine 3,000 people? But you can kind of tell, I think, listening to this, that there's a, it's like, it's kind of intimate. You can hear some specific individuals yelling. You can hear like the crowd. It's not like the 80s show we'd listen to where it's just like a sea of crowd noise, 'cause you know, it's 80,000 people. But you know, in 10 years, which is a long time, but in 10 years, it goes from 3,000 to 85,000, you know,
on like a nightly basis.
Insane. Totally insane. And you know, like he was in 75, he was like, this was around the time when John Landau, you know, said his saw the future of rock. Right. And people started calling him an overnight success. And I think it started around this exact time, right? Like, 'cause like you said, Born to Run comes out right after this or right before?
Just before. And I mean,
okay,
to everything you're saying, like where he's at, you know, E Street Shuffle, his previous record, does not do well. It does not sell. Greetings from Asbury Park does not sell. And he's about to be dropped from his label and basically throws everything possible into making Born to Run. And, you know, it kind of gets into what you're talking about. It gets into one of the themes that I had, which I was thinking about when listening to this, is like the idea of pushing a band beyond its limits. And you hear it on this record. And it's something that, like, by the time we get to 85, this is a band that's working incredibly hard on a night-to-night basis, and it's probably part of the reason why they have like 3 years left before they take a 10 to 15 year hiatus. But, you know, I was thinking about the idea of there's no guarantee at this point that Springsteen is going to become a household name. There's a lot of artists in this part of the country that are vying for that next step. And Springsteen hears the need for both perfection, but also a looseness and this sound that just like overwhelms you, but also hugs you. And for him playing in front of 3,000 people, it sounds as though it's the biggest gig of his entire life. And while on the outside, you could say like, well, Born to Run is a hit at this point in time. It's going to become one of the biggest albums of all time. The song Born to Run is going to be regarded as one of the top 10 best classic rock songs ever, you know, regardless the list. He's going to be loved. He's going to be embraced. But this is like still the moment where there's an unknown of what is going to happen in his career. And that's so fascinating to think about listening to this.
Yeah, there's an urgency to it too, you know, in the performance, which I think is amazing. So one thing we, you know, well, let me ask you a trivia question, Brian. What's the one thing or one of the main things that connects this artist to the artist that we, to the Dave Matthews Band?
I don't know.
To me, it's saxophone. Yeah. We gotta, you know, this is a Clarence heavy show, you know, that,
yeah.
It's before, I think that's the thing about like the synthesizers and the stuff that comes in the 80s. Some of this stuff is like drowned out a little bit, I guess, you know, it, when you really hear this stripped down band before they really, you know, like basically before like people started using effects, like in the way that, that, you know, they start to in the 80s, it's kind of amazing how prominent he is and just how much of a part of the sound Clarence is. And I think it's just amazing.
This is a really interesting point. I mean, first and foremost, yeah, Clarence, you can hear, I mean, there's so much personality in the E Street Band, and you think of Clarence, you think of Little Steven as kind of these like offshoots of Bruce's personality in a lot of cases. And without them, the entirety of those bands change, that band changes completely, where he has Clarence as kind of like the big older brother that he can lean on to and like carry a moment in the show and carry him. And Little Steven is kind of like his wingman that he can just get into a ton of trouble with. And like, that's the vibe I get of them. You know, Max is kind of like the elder statesman behind, you know, kind of making sure that everything is running smoothly as the band goes forward. And the band would change and evolve over the years. But, you know, there's an element of like, everybody is there for Bruce, but also he needs everyone in the band to be at his absolute best. But also your other point about like the comparison between the sax heavy aspect to this show versus the synth heavy aspect of the 85 show. I went and saw Dylan about 2 weeks ago. And one thing that blew me away, there was not a single effect pedal on stage. The sound of the show was just pure, clear, clean instruments. And it's something I think a lot about, this idea of Springsteen being this connector between the past and the future, is what made rock and roll so revolutionary was not necessarily distortion. It was rhythm. And it was taking chords that had been used in country music and applying them at a faster pace and applying them with like this urgency that made people dance and move in a way and made people feel things that they'd never felt before. And at the time, nobody could have predicted that like the distortion pedal is going to come in and the synthesizer is going to come in and all these effects and grandstands. Like the rock music was really simple at its heart. And one thing that's fascinating about listening to this show, there's no effects. It's just, this is what the instrument sounds like. And we are going to blow this instrument out as much as possible to ensure that this instrument raises the temperature and the volume of these songs rather than rely in any sort of way on an effect, which is not to say anything negative about effects. It's more just like he's pushing these instruments as far as they can go.
Yeah, definitely. I totally agree with that. Well, let's talk about a couple highlights. I mean,
yeah.
What are your highlights, I guess, like musically here?
I mean, I think for me, Lost in the Flood is always going to be a show-stopping moment, and having that come as the fourth song in a set, you get that and Spirit of the Night as this kind of like throwback to Asbury Park and the earliest era of Bruce Springsteen and his songwriting, to get like this couplet of Thunder Road, 10th Avenue, Freeze Out. Like, this is the new album. We're pushing the new album, which it's crazy to think these are new songs at the time. Go back to Asbury Park, come back with She's the One and Born to Run to kind of end the introductory part of this show as showcasing Asbury Park and Born to Run. But Lost in the Flood, there's just those lyrics, the piano, like there's so much concocted in there. And it got me thinking about like my last theme for this. And we could talk about it throughout this set, but is the idea of like, this is the end of Beat Generation Bruce. Like if you look at the lyric insert on Greetings for Asbury Park, like the songs are like this long and everything is like a full run on sentence, like line that he's singing. This is like him channeling Bob Dylan and using a thesaurus to write every single lyric. And by the time we get to Darkness on the Edge of Town, which is his next record, that's kind of going to be gone. He's going to be way more direct. But what were some of your highlights initially?
Oh yeah, that's a good point. I mean, Kitty's back. You know, the 17-minute jam and like an actual jam. You know, and that's why I love this era so much, because it is, like you said, it's they're relying more on the instruments, but you know, there's just something about it that is just, I don't know. I really like it. I had a lot of fun listening to the show, and I was sort of surprised at how much different it sounded to me than, you know, the one we listened to yesterday. So I love that. I think the, you know, Thunder Road, 10th Avenue, Freeze Out, Spirit in the Night, Lost in the Flood, that four song, you know, combo opener is pretty amazing. That's a pretty great way to open a show. Thunder Road is, you know, like you can't help but just like singing along, and you know, it's a really great show. I think, you know, in the Phish world we talk about like the fourth quarter, you know, a lot, and to me, like the fourth quarter of Bruce shows are almost always like, I don't need to listen to them. You know, like the Detroit medley, it's always like, you know, and then we're going to like do some, it's kind of like that live, you know, the No Nukes tour. There's like a medley with like some guests, and it's just like it's fun, but like, I guess in that kind of setting, I would prefer to just like have more, I would just prefer to have more Bruce songs, you know what I mean? But like, I don't know, we're not talking about the No Nukes show, but I know you know that, but like the Detroit medley has Tom Petty and Jackson Browne, and that's like, that's cool, and there's like some cool fun stuff happening there, but you know, by the time you get through all the hits, it's sort of like, okay, we've heard it all. But I assume you feel differently.
No, I actually feel the exact same. The encore of this show was it was not my favorite part of the show. I don't think I would say least favorite, but like, I think all of it is great. I think the point is like, it gets back to something I was thinking a lot about with this show of like, this is still the era where Bruce is pulling a lot from 60s soul revival and rockabilly and early stages of rock and roll that I personally, I'll just put my cards out there, I think I would lean towards the 85 show in terms of what I would go back to. Mm-hmm. I really love the 1980s. I really love the sound that you get out of that. And I love how you're adding in songs from Darkness, The River, Nebraska, and Born in the USA to that.
Yeah.
And by adding those songs, you remove a lot of the need for, you still get like Twist and Shout. You still get like Jersey Girl. You get these moments where he's catering towards the past, and you can see like Barroom Bruce come back and be like, well, nobody wants to hear my song. They want to hear a song that they know just reinterpreted by me.
Yeah.
But this is definitely an era where it's like more heavily skewed that way. I want to ask you about a specific song though, because there's one performance here that I don't want to say offends me. It's a little bit aggressive, but one of my favorite early Bruce songs is a song called For You, which comes mm-hmm. late on Greens for Asbury Park. It is this like rollicking beat, this just incredible piano work, and this song of just like lost love that he sings about in a way that like, I personally don't think he's ever sang better. Mm-hmm. This idea of like, you know, like I did all of this for you, like for the two of us, and it didn't work out. It wasn't good. And it's not my fault. And that's a really interesting place to write from, because that is really selfish, really self-centered, mm-hmm. but like for him to do it in a way that sounds really appealing blows me away. And in all these live performances, he turns For You into this very forlorn, like emo ballad on the piano mm-hmm. that just mm-hmm. does not, it's too much emotion. That's too serious. Whereas the actual song on the record, it feels more lighthearted with the music. I don't know your thoughts on that. If you have a connection to that song.
Interesting. Yeah. I hadn't thought about that. I mean, this song disappeared for like a solid decade.
Yeah.
And like the whole, they didn't play it in the '80s at all. It was played in 81 and then the next in 92. So there's something Maybe like some of those songs that came in between, you know, like the songs you were talking about that were played heavily in the '80s, kind of like were the next phase of his, you know, emotional songwriting that were a little more like authentic to the sound.
It's an interesting point, and it makes me think that like Tunnel of Love is kind of the updated, like that whole record is the updated cut of the views that he was expressing on For You.
Yeah, 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 exactly. But yeah, I mean, I feel like this with like the Dave Matthews shows we talked about and with some Bruce show, there's some parts where you're like, okay, I know this is like a little much, you know? I guess that happens with most bands we listen to, but it's still fun to listen to though.
Do you find sometimes when you listen to Bruce, like when I listen to him, there's so much for me nostalgia and like an appreciation of what path he carved for rock stars as they went forward, a love obviously for the music. There's so much of that like mixed in that like for me to get really critical about Bruce, I have to like listen to it in a different frame of mind. And when I do get critical, I think to myself of like, my God, this guy took everything that he said so goddamn seriously. And you get that in a lot of this where like, he's just like overemphasizing words and overemphasizing phrases.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
As though like that word means everything, that phrase means everything, which I really appreciate as someone who loves like Bob Dylan. But I also like in this era, I don't know if it's that I can't get past it. It's that like sometimes it feels overwrought in a sense to me.
Yeah, I think that's fair. Well, I think we agree that this is a good show. I mean, there's obviously some, you know, some nuances that we've talked through. What's your most boss moment of the show?
Before I say that, I think we have to say one more thing. There's one very special thing that happens in this show that we have to shout out. And that is the debut of the song, It's My Life, which comes after that first opening segment that ends with Born to Run. This is the first confirmed version of the Animal song, It's My Life.
Mm-hmm.
Famously, in a 1987 BBC documentary, Max Weinberg spoke about the premiere of It's My Life when he was asked if Bruce ever launched into a song without telling the band what he was going to play. Max said that the band had never released the song before playing it in concert, but fortunately they all knew it. And there's a really great write-up. There's awesome essays that go along with all of these releases. One thing I want to just note out here is fan accounts confirm It's My Life was not soundchecked at the CW Post, yet out of thin air it begins, minus the familiar story intro. For the first minute or so, the band feels its way through the arrangement, deferential to the original, but being E-Streetized right before our ears. Confidence grows, and somewhere close to the middle of the song, they realize we've got this. It's My Life would go on to become a setlist staple for the next year and into early 1977. This is such a fascinating moment on the record that I didn't appreciate the first time I listened to it until I went back and read these essays about the record and re-listened to it. And like, you hear this band that is fully capable of in the moment playing a song that none of them know how to play, but then they all learn and they all kind of connect with each other in this like interwoven web of music. It's such a cool moment on the record and speaks to where Bruce was at this point in time.
Nice. That's awesome. Thanks for bringing that up. I'm just going to tell you that I think I'm just not used to this band being a jam band, you know? And the Kitty's Back is just it's so great. It's not like, they're not forcing anything. It's just like an actual 15 or 17 minute jam that really just develops. And I just think it's really, that's a great moment.
I agree. I think Kitty's Back, it kind of speaks to them as a jam band, as a band that finds a groove and allows that groove to just like build and like hang, like linger over the audience and linger over the show, but then build and build and build. There's not like changes in the way that like a Phish or a Dead jam does, where they try to escape the song. It's let's just let this song build and marinate and like wash over you. And so you're really just left as a listener of like the groove that they're playing is so worth hearing over and over and over again. And all the everyone in this band is playing like a session musician in terms of like nobody's missing a note, but there's also this like looseness where it feels like it could fall apart. It's such a cool moment, and it feels like something that would just like it'll lead towards huge moments in the band's career going forward.
What's your moment?
For me, it's the end of the main set, the Backstreets, Kitty's Back, Jungle Land, and Rosalita. And it kind of speaks to what I was saying about the intro of the show. You know, a lot of these songs are like Rosalita is going to disappear for decades, and it's going to become a rare song going forward. A lot of these songs, though, these are the biggest songs that Springsteen has right now. And it speaks to something that you'll hear throughout his career going forward. Where when he releases a record, he seems to know instinctually, this is the song that needs to be overemphasized. This is a song that needs to be pushed out. This is the song that needs to be pushed out to listeners and needs to be like just blown apart. And he does that with these songs. Backstreets is almost 9 minutes. Kitty's Back is 18 minutes. Jungle Land is 10 minutes. Rosalita is 14 minutes. Like you're in this 40-minute segment of music, 45-minute segment of music that is just like the best melodies, the best lyrics that Springsteen has ever written pushed to you beyond your limits, beyond his limits, beyond the band's limits. And that sentiment is something that is going to define so many Springsteen shows going forward.
That's awesome. That's awesome. Thank you for that. This is so fun. Next week on Tuesday, we're going to jump forward to 1988, the Downbound Train debut, tour debut, 34 song set. There's some stuff happening here. This is part of, I mean, this is wild.
This is the Tunnel of Love tour. This is, yeah, this Tunnel is really of Love. Good stuff.
We got like, there's a lot happening here. And so we're excited to check that out. I wasn't, there's a lot to like here. So I guess I'll leave it at that. 'Cause there's a lot to discuss. A Downbound Train being, you know, making its debut on the tour. That's a highlight for me, but there's lots of other stuff, which we're going to talk about on Tuesday. So, we hope you're enjoying what we're doing here. And if you're listening to this, share it, give us a review. And if you're watching, thank you. And I think that's everything, Brian. Anything else?
No, this was great. This was a great intro here this week to Springsteen through Born in the USA as well as Born to Run. And I'm excited to get into next week. We get into some nuanced areas as well as an all-time classic show, which I can't wait to kind of peel back the layers here, Bruce.
Amazing. Amazing. Thank you guys so much for listening and watching. And we will, we're going to talk to you guys soon. So thank you.
Thanks, everyone. We'll talk with you.
Osiris.